Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, a battle over abortion rights between Texas and New York lands in Ulster County. We'll speak to the local Ulster County official who is defying a Texas court order and why the stakes could reach all the way to the Supreme Court. New York just passed the nation's strongest all-electric building code, a bold move to cut climate pollution and push back on federal rollbacks. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim speaks with Rewiring America about what this means for homes, utility bills, and the state's clean energy future. Did you know there's a local resource helping babies prepare for school even before they can walk? We'll talk to the Wayne County Family Center and find out how they're supporting families. And zoinks! A Scooby-Doo parody is putting a wild spin on a cartoon classic. Coming up after the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Dale Willman. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported an uptick in inflation last month. As NPR's Scott Horsley reports, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 90 points in early trading.
The Commerce Department says consumer prices in June were up 2.6% from a year ago. That's a bigger annual increase than the previous month. Stripping out volatile food and energy prices, core inflation was 2.8%. The department's inflation yardstick is closely watched by the Federal Reserve. Yesterday, Fed policymakers voted 9-2 to hold interest rates steady as the central bank tries to wrestle inflation back down to its target of 2%. Some members of the Fed's rate-setting committee worry that President Trump's tariffs are pushing prices in the opposite direction. New claims for unemployment benefits showed little change last week. We'll get a more complete picture of the U.S. job market tomorrow from the Labor Department. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney says his government will recognize a Palestinian state when the UN General Assembly meets in September.
This intention is predicated on the Palestinian Authority's commitment to much-needed reforms, including commitments by the Palestinian Authority's President Abbas to fundamentally reform its governance, to hold general elections in 2026 in which Hamas can play no part, and to demilitarize the Palestinian state.
Carney's announcement comes just days after France made a similar commitment. More than 140 countries now support a Palestinian state. The National Transportation Safety Board is holding 3 days of hearings on the mid-air crash between a regional jet and a military helicopter near Washington, D.C. earlier this year. As NPR's Joe Hernandez reports, testimony so far is focused on altitude discrepancies and the crowded D.C. airspace.
The crash occurred at 278 feet of altitude, even though the Army Black Hawk helicopter shouldn't have been flying higher than 200 feet in that area. Yet several Army representatives said it's not uncommon for barometric altimeters to have discrepancies of that amount or more. Witnesses also testified about the crowded airspace around Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport, or D.C. There had been concerns in the past about Army helicopter routes passing near the busy airport, as well as discussions about eliminating or changing the route. The NTSB will also hear testimony on air traffic control at the airport, collision avoidance technology, and more. Joe Hernandez, NPR News, Washington.
Some 25 passengers were injured overnight when their Delta Airlines flight was hit by serious turbulence. The flight from Salt Lake City to Amsterdam was diverted to an airport in Minnesota so those injured could be taken to local hospitals. Serious injuries from turbulence are rare, but scientists say such incidents will become more common as climate change alters the jet stream. You're listening to NPR News. At least 8 people were killed and more than 50 others injured today when a Russian missile and drone attack on the capital of Kyiv hit a 9-story residential building. Much of the building collapsed, trapping an unknown number of people in the rubble. At least 27 separate areas across the country were hit in this latest attack. NASA and SpaceX are preparing to launch a crew of 4 to the International Space Station from Florida's Kennedy Space Center in just over 2 hours. Central Florida Public Media's Brendan Byrne has more on that story.
SpaceX's Dragon capsule will carry 2 U.S. astronauts, 1 from Japan, and a Russian cosmonaut. After launching, it will take about a day and a half to make it to the station. Once there, the crew will spend about 6 months living and working aboard the orbiting lab. The mission's pilot, Mike Fink, will mark his fourth trip to space, launching previously on NASA's space shuttle and Russia's Soyuz capsule. It will be the first space flight for Commander Zena Cardman. She was set to launch the station last year, but was bumped from that mission to make room for NASA's Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams. The agency determined their ride to space, Boeing's Starliner capsule, was unsafe to return them. Instead, they returned to Earth in SpaceX's capsule. For NPR News, I'm Brendan Byrne in Orlando.
More flights have been canceled today at London's Heathrow Airport. That comes just one day after more than 120 flights around the country were canceled on Wednesday because of technical problems with the country's air traffic control system. Wednesday's delay lasted for about 20 minutes, and it caused travel problems throughout the day. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. And some breaking news in the weather. A flash flood warning has been issued by the National Weather Service just about a minute ago. At 10.04 a.m., Doppler radar indicated thunderstorms producing heavy rain across Orange County. Between 1 and 2 inches of rain have fallen. The expected rainfall rate is up to 1 inch an hour. Additional rainfall amounts of up to an inch are possible in Orange County. And flash flooding is ongoing or expected to begin shortly. Some locations that could experience or will experience flash flooding include Middletown, Port Jervis, Goshen, Chester, Montgomery, Cuttybackville, Otisville, and other communities in Orange County. A reminder, turn around. Don't drown when encountering flooded roads. Most flood deaths occur in vehicles. Excessive runoff from heavy rainfall will cause flooding of urban areas, highways, streets, and underpasses, as well as other drainage areas and low-lying spots. Again, a flash flood warning in effect until 11:30 this morning for Orange County. There is a flash flood watch for the rest of the area from noon today until this evening. And that includes our listening area in central New York, Delaware, Ulster, of course, Sullivan and Orange, and northeast Pennsylvania. That is going on through late tonight with flash flooding with this excessive rainfall. Be alert, be prepared, and stay with Radio Catskill for further weather updates throughout the day. Now, a battle over abortion rights between Texas and New York has landed in Ulster County. And Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has filed suit against the Ulster County Clerk for repeatedly refusing to file a summary judgment against a New York doctor who prescribed abortion pills to a Texas patient via telehealth. Paxton first sued Dr. Margaret Carpenter of New Paltz in civil court last year for allegedly violating the state's abortion ban. Texas prohibits nearly all abortions, but New York has refused to cooperate with Texas in accordance with its SHIELD law, which protects abortion providers from out-of-state lawsuits. When Carpenter failed to respond to the suit, a Texas judge issued a permanent injunction and more than a $100,000 fine against her, but that still hasn't been carried out. Twice, acting Ulster County Clerk Taylor Brook says he has received orders from Paxton to file the judgment against Carpenter in New York, but he won't do it. That decision has ignited a constitutional clash that may end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke with Taylor Brook yesterday.
The first time that we received the judgment, the nature of the judgment is what initially stood out. They did specifically list in the judgment what it was for. They referenced Dr. Carpenter and that, as you said, she was accused of providing abortion medication to Texas, and that was fairly unusual. We generally don't see those kind of details in judgments. And then, of course, the fact that it was from the Texas Attorney General's office directly stood out to us. And it really flagged that this was a unique circumstance and a unique judgment, not our typical run-of-the-mill paperwork that we file hundreds of times every day.
Yeah. And so you initially rejected the order, I guess, right, when it came in?
We did. We looked into the New York SHIELD law and read the language to see if we were covered, and double-checked with some legal counsel to get their interpretation of the SHIELD law as well. But it was unprecedented. There is no precedent set for whether or not the Shield Law applies in this circumstance, like for a clerk necessarily. And so we had a choice to make: potentially break the Shield Law and be sued by our constituent here, or reject the filing and almost certainly be sued by Texas. And for me here, that was an easy enough decision. I'm going to do everything we can to protect our constituents.
Yeah, and it seems like that's what happened. It seems like after you rejected, a second attempt has been made, and now the Texas is suing you, or suing the, you know, Ulster County. When the second one came in, did anything change in your response, or you're just still steadfast on protecting the constituents?
Nothing really changed in our response. I was a little more forceful in the response. Their second attempt contained a letter that basically demanded that I file it. And, you know, Texas doesn't have any jurisdiction over me or my office here. So I didn't respond well to being demanded to do something by them. But they didn't change anything about the judgment itself. It was the same thing. So the same procedure took place. The Shield Law still stands, in my opinion. And so we rejected it a second time and essentially told them that the first time we rejected it, it was final. They can submit it all they want, but it's not going to change what we're doing.
Yeah, you mentioned the New York Shield Law. Just go over a little bit, just in case folks don't know what that is. Your decisions was based on the New York Shield Law. So can you just go over, like, explain how that law guided your actions as the county clerk?
Of course. So the Shield Law is intended to protect New York State residents from being sued by other states for things exactly like this. It actually specifically spells out telehealth medication and reproductive health care that is legal in New York State. But the language is broad. It essentially says that no government employee shall comply with a civil or criminal proceeding related to a healthcare service provided that is legal in New York State. And so we walk through every step of that language. And I am a government employee. A judgment is a civil part of a civil suit. And so it was pretty clear to us that we should not be complying with this, given that the healthcare service rendered was legal in New York State. The doctor had never left New York State. To me, it was clear. The Shield Law protected the doctor and allowed us to reject it.
Right. And this law was enacted in 2023 following the Dobbs versus Jackson's women's health decision to ensure in-state providers aren't penalized for treating patients in states with abortion bans, like what's happening now in the UN Texas. So this name, now that you're named in a lawsuit, how are you preparing what could be sort of a long legal battle, possibly all the way to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, it's really fascinating and stressful. We have good attorneys here at the county. We were actually just served the paperwork this morning. So our next step will be working on our response to the lawsuit. I'm not exactly sure what that will look like at this point, but it does seem, like you said, like it'll first be heard in New York State Supreme Court. And I think it's likely that either way, the judge in New York State Supreme Court rules, there's a high likelihood that it gets appealed, and it kind of crawls its way up the court system until ultimately the question as to whether or not Shield Laws, not just in New York State, but really nationwide, are constitutional. I think that question is at the crux of this case, and that's what makes it really a story a lot bigger than just our office here.
This could set a precedent for this type of laws.
It very well could. We haven't gotten, we being America, hasn't gotten a ruling from the Supreme Court as to the constitutionality of Shield Laws yet. And we'll see what happens. But there is the chance that this is what kind of sparks a decision having to be made on this.
Yeah. Now, I'm just curious for you personally, you know, you're named in this lawsuit. How does it make you feel personally and professionally?
Personally, it's kind of shocking. It's the first time I've ever been sued. I'm just fortunate that we do have good attorneys on our side, and I believe that we have the law on our side. What's more concerning to me beyond the lawsuit is kind of the rhetoric that's being used from Texas. In Ken Paxton's press release, he talked about how the radical liberals in New York are trying to kill as many babies as possible. And as a new father of a three-month-old daughter at home, that's very offensive to me, but also like threatening. Like that kind of language is what radicalizes people and causes political violence. And I wish that we could keep this argument in the courts and have the constitutionality debate without accusing people of just completely absurd things like that. We should be able to have a civil discussion about the constitutionality of the Shield laws without accusing people of intentionally murdering babies.
Yeah. And what was the kind of support you have received or pressure, for that matter, have you received from state officials or advocacy groups or the public since this case began?
We've seen really an overwhelming outpouring of support from virtually all of our local elected officials, our county executive up to our congressman and the governor, the attorney general. All of them have put out statements in favor of what we did. The public has been overwhelmingly supportive. We receive letters here in the office almost every day from really all around the country supporting what we did. And there's only been one or two threats at this point. It's been probably 90-10 supportive to not supportive. And that makes me feel good. It makes me feel like not only did we make the right decision, but we're doing what the public feels is right and standing up for our constituent in this case. And we're just fortunate to live in a state like New York that had the foresight to pass something like the Shield Law that gave us the legal covering to do something like this and to protect our constituent.
Yeah, well, let's talk about some of the criticism. You know, some people could say that it's just your job to file the paperwork and not to make a decision about it, but what would you say to them?
I would say that they're generally right, that is our job, to just file the paperwork and not make discretionary decisions. And that's what made the Shield Law interesting, and that it just explicitly said that we shall not comply with those things. So there was a contradiction there. And the way I saw it was that we were potentially breaking the law one way or the other. We were either not doing my constitutional duty in filing the paperwork or breaking the Shield Law that is a New York state law. And I did swear an oath to uphold the laws of the state of New York. And so we were put in an interesting spot that it appears there's since been a pretty eloquent solution to. There. It looks like in the future, there will just be a little checkbox on out-of-state proceedings that just say, I agree that this proceeding is not related to a healthcare service provided that's legal in New York, so that the onus is on the other states to confirm that they're abiding by New York State Shield Law instead of the clerks making a discretionary decision. But that did not exist when we first got this in. So I would generally agree with those people and their criticism, but this was a unique situation, an unprecedented situation, and we had to make a judgment call in this case that going forward, we won't have to.
Now, looking forward, what do you think is at stake here for town clerks like you and local officials across the country if the courts rule one way or the other in this case?
Oh, I think there's a lot at stake. I think what's really at stake is states' rights, which is sort of ironic that we in New York are making the states' rights argument in this case. But either way they rule, whether or not the Shield Law is constitutional or not, I can see ways where it is abused. I can see states like Texas or red states having Shield Laws that protect people from, say, gun-related charges, things like that. Like I can see it getting out of hand really quickly. This is one of the problems with having states' rights and having different laws have different states. You're going to inevitably run into conflicts because it's extremely easy to cross state lines, and we all still live in the same country. So it can get very confusing very fast. I think it's a good illustration of why for certain things you do want a strong federal government that had laws like Roe v. Wade that just laid out nationwide, here are the rules. When you do it on a state-by-state basis, things like this are inevitable.
Taylor, before we go, is there anything else I have not covered that you want to say?
No, I don't think so. Again, I would just thank all of the other local elected officials who have stood up for us and for the Shield Law and gave us the support that we kind of desperately need. We're really fortunate to live in a state that cares about things like women's reproductive rights and that fights vigorously for that.
Well, Taylor, again, thank you so much for talking to Acting Ulster County Clerk Taylor Brook, who was being sued by the Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton for refusing to file a Texas court judgment against a New York doctor. Taylor, thank you so much for talking to us, and I'm sure we'll talk again in the future as this case unfolds.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
And thank you, Patricio. We'll take a break, and when we come back, as federal climate protections are rolled back, New York is doubling down. The state's new all-electric building code could reshape how we heat and power our homes. Next, Julia Kim tells us what's at stake and what's next for this new climate protection. This is Radio Chatsco.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we're going to go down a rabbit hole of Colombian queer slurs and slang that have gone from insults to everyday filler words.
Perhaps this is about much more than just semantics and translations. Perhaps being in a relationship with an American man in the U.S. also means I'm experiencing a different kind of queer sensibility through English.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
On the next Jazz Night in America, we're in Rhode Island for an hour of historic music from the Newport Jazz Festival through the years, handpicked and hosted by me, Christian McBride. Rare recordings by Ray Charles and saxophonist Cannonball Adderley, Sarah Vaughan hitting her stride, and later year performances from Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong. You're not going to want to miss this. Join me for Jazz Night in America, Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And a reminder, as we're on live this hour, the National Weather Service has issued a flash flood warning for Orange County. That's in effect until 11:30 this morning. Radar shows strong thunderstorms dropping heavy rain across the area. Between 1 and 2 inches of rain have already fallen, with an additional half to 1 inch possible. Flash flooding is either happening now or expected to begin shortly. Rapid flooding of creeks, streams, streets, underpasses, and low-lying areas are possible, with affected communities including Middletown, Port Jervis, Walden, Goshen, Montgomery, Chester, Otisville, Cuttybackville, and surrounding areas. Remember, turn around, don't drown, never drive through flooded roads. Most flood-related deaths happen in vehicles. And again, there's a flash flood warning in effect for Orange County until 11:30 this morning. The rest of the region remains under a flash flood watch until late tonight. Stay tuned to Radio Catskill for updates and other emergency information. Last Friday, New York State adopted the strongest all-electric building code in the country, requiring most new homes and buildings to run entirely on electricity within the next few years. It's a major step in reducing climate pollution from buildings, which are New York's number one source of emissions. The move is also seen as a direct response to federal rollbacks, including President Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill, which climate activists warn could raise costs and undermine state-level progress. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim had the chance to speak with Michael Hernandez, New York Policy Director of Rewiring America. He's been working on state and local electrification policies that aim to protect residents, lower utility bills, and move New York off of fossil fuels.
New York is going electric. In a major move towards cutting dependence on fossil fuels, New York is now the first state to require newly constructed buildings to be made fully electric after the State Fire Prevention and Building Code Council's meeting last Friday. Starting in 2026, new buildings that are 7 stories or less, whether residential or commercial, must be built with all electric rather than fossil fuel equipment to curb New York's top source of carbon emissions, buildings. By 2029, all newly constructed buildings, besides stated exceptions such as hospitals or restaurants in New York, will be mandated to use electric heat and appliances in a challenge against federal rollbacks on climate action programs. The state law behind the All-Electric Building Code, known as the All-Electric Buildings Act, was actually passed 2 years ago and was a result of organizing by climate advocates who found themselves up against the combined forces of fossil fuel companies, gas utilities, and real estate. Quote, a real battle to get past, said Assemblymember Emily Gallagher, who was the bill's main sponsor at a virtual press conference on Friday. The act was only just implemented into New York's building code, which sets the standards for building construction in the state and is renewed every 5 years. After repeated issues of the all-electric provision not being included in preliminary drafts of the 2025 code, despite it being legally required. The state's move towards electricity was further bolstered by a legal victory back in March, in which a district court judge dismissed a challenge to a similar electrification law in New York City brought upon by plumbing and building trade groups. Alongside Gallagher, other policymakers, climate activists, and local contractors in support of the act came together to speak at the press conference immediately following the council meeting on Friday. One of the featured speakers, Michael Hernandez, has been active in the nationwide fight for electrification as New York policy director for the nonprofit Rewiring America. I had the chance to individually speak with Hernandez afterwards on the state's monumental shift towards electricity and how it stands to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, lower energy costs for New Yorkers, and protect residents from health risks. My first question is, during the press conference, you guys mentioned how buildings are the top source of emissions in New York State. And with that, I was wondering, you know, why are our buildings such a big part of the climate problem in New York? And what is unique about our infrastructure compared to other states that makes it our top source?
As part of the climate law that was enacted in 2019, we created the Climate Action Scoping Plan, Climate Action Council, and they did an analysis. We charged them with determining and having the Department of Environmental Conservation determine where are our emissions coming from. And I think it was through that annual greenhouse gas emission inventory that we discovered that it's the way that New Yorkers heat their homes, heat their water, cook their food, that actually contributes the most to our greenhouse gas emissions. It's about a little over 33% of our greenhouse gas emissions. And I think in New York City, more around 70%. A large number of homes in New York State use fossil fuels to heat their homes. And that really drives up costs for those homes, health impacts. I'll also note that New York consumes the most amount of heating oil in the country. We actually, the Northeast uses the most amount of heating oil. And then within the Northeast, New York is right at top in consumption.
So the code mandates that new construction be made electric within the next few years because, you know, electric homes, as you mentioned, often use heat pumps, induction stoves, and other technologies that are just more generally energy efficient. And I was wondering if you can walk us through how electric appliances compare to their traditional gas counterparts in terms of first climate impact and then two, you know, cost, comfort, and reliability for users.
I think really what you see with electrified appliances is that it's really the state of the art. You know, when you're using fossil fuels to cook or heat your home, you're looking at technology that was developed like 100 years ago, right? Like the induction stoves, like the appliances that heat pumps, these are state of the art technologies that literally move heat in the air from one place from outside to inside or from the ground to inside and do so in a very efficient way. And so energy costs go down, comfort levels go up, and you just have a lot more resiliency with electrified appliances as well. You can have battery backup within the appliance itself. You can have energy storage systems, and then you can also have your own sources of renewable energy generation, whether that's a solar power on your roof that's feeding into your energy storage system in your garage, and then that's powering all of your appliances, and you're not even spending money on utilities trying to bring over energy to your home.
In the press comments, you had mentioned when responding to one of the questions about how a provision of the legislation talked about renewable energy as a resource for these, you know, newly all electric buildings. I was wondering if you could go into that specific provision a little bit.
Absolutely. As part of what's included in this energy code update is a requirement for newly constructed buildings that there will be on-site renewable energy generation. And so it's a great combination when you're requiring the electric, your building to be electrified, and then you also require renewable energy generation, you're making that building so much more independent and resilient, because now it can actually generate its own electricity and utilize that electricity for its own operations to keep the home warm, to keep the water warm, to cook your food, like everything you need. And so that's the kind of grid of the future that we're really looking for. The 20th century kind of, we generate electricity 50, 100 miles away, and then we send it down transmission lines, you know, that is an outdated model. And we're updating now to do more distributed energy sources and have your own energy sources that are close to your home and much far cheaper and more affordable and cleaner.
Senator Liz Krueger, who has been an advocate for the bill as Senate Finance Chair, said that the act is set to create about 100,000 jobs for New Yorkers during the press conference. Furthermore, Hernandez explained that the New Yorkers who live in these all-electric buildings should also plan to see cost reductions on the consumption side, which works in tandem with New York's other major goal to increase affordable housing. The state says this code will not only create jobs, like you just said, but also save households close to about $1,000 a year in energy bills. How do these savings actually happen, and who stands to benefit the most from these cost savings?
Yeah, they happen in a number of ways. I think the appliances themselves are far more efficient, and so like they use a lot less energy in their operation than conventional appliances. Also, they have a lot more nuance and technology built into them. So you can determine, for instance, if you have an EV vehicle, you might say, oh, I'm going to charge that at nighttime when there's not peak demand on the grid. And if I have a time of use rate, then I can actually charge my car battery up at a time when my energy costs are very low. And so that's just an example of some of the ways, and you can do that with any kind of appliance where you can say, oh, well, I'll charge up this battery, or I'll, you know, have this task programmed to occur at a time when energy is cheaper.
I mean, opponents have kind of argued that, you know, electrification raises construction costs and burdens contractors. And I was wondering, you know, what have you been hearing from builders and labor groups about this code? And can you kind of speak to the specific point of critique on the legislation?
Yeah, I mean, I think we had a building developer at our press conference today, Rise Borough. They have built numerous all-electric, multifamily, low-income, mixed-income households. Buildings that are all electric. And they, as they said in the press conference, you know, they did not see any cost increase by being all electric. And in fact, what they saw was for the tenants of those buildings, operational savings going forward. And I think that that's an important factor, because often the tenants of those buildings, or the owners of those buildings after they're built, are basically stuck with whatever the building developer chose for whatever reason they chose that. But you're the one who has to pay the energy bills going forward. And so it's interesting to have like a building developer say, you know, for us, there was no difference in the price between going all electric or fossil fuel. And really, the difference was how much did the future owners or tenants have to pay in energy costs.
Furthermore, Jay Best, CEO of Green Team Long Island, said to the press that, quote, the contractors are ready. Green Team Long Island is a contractor that has been offering electric appliances such as energy-efficient heat pumps to New Yorkers that Best said have come to outsell traditional furnaces and have become, quote, something that we're comfortable doing. For Lonnie J. Portis, who represented the community-based organization We Act for Environmental Justice as its Director of Policy and Legislative Affairs at the press conference, the act has a critical public health dimension as well. Portis described how fossil fuel emissions from buildings have contributed to nearly 2,000 premature deaths across the state, with studies showing that low-income communities and communities of color are facing the brunt of these health issues. Riseborough CEO Kieran Harrington spoke specifically to Bushwick, which currently suffers the highest concentration of asthma hospitalizations for children due to fossil fuel emissions from homes, while his community partnership is actively trying to combat this issue by building affordable all-electric homes in the predominantly Hispanic neighborhood. Health risk will persist in a largely fossil fuel landscape.
You know, what does research say about indoor air pollution from traditional gas appliances? And how would this code help reduce health risks, especially for marginalized communities who have disproportionately been burdened by them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we've seen, research has shown, is that within environmental justice communities, there is a disproportionate health impact. And it's in the aggregate, right? Because if you have a lot of polluting sources within your community, and then you also, on top of that, have polluting appliances within your apartment, you know, or your living space, and then you have a lot of people all in a smaller space, all kind of together. All of those things are a compounding impact of health disparity that creates asthma and emphysema and a lot of other health issues related to, you know, burning fossil fuels in your house, in your home. And so by electrifying our energy code, you're moving new homes that are built, multifamily homes, affordable homes, they will no longer have these harmful fumes and gases that are being emitted in the living space and impacting the people who live there.
And electrification doesn't stop there. Alongside the All Electric Buildings Act, the 100-foot gas rule was also repealed in the state's 2025 legislative session, which had cost New Yorkers $200 million annually to subsidize utility companies for the cost of extending gas lines to properties located within 100 feet of an existing line. In addition, a cap and invest program was proposed to help 46% of households in New York upgrade to an energy-efficient heat pump by 2035, saving the median household between $800 to $1,000 annually in terms of energy costs. However, this comes as the energy landscape in New York is becoming increasingly shaky. Trump's elimination of the clean energy tax credits that came out of the Biden administration's 2022 Inflation Reduction Act means renewable energy generation will become more costly to implement. These popular tax breaks had made it cheaper for both individual Americans and renewable energy companies to build and install infrastructure for renewable energy. And now solar and wind companies are left with only a year with these federal credits to carry out their projects, according to New York Focus. As the push towards electrification is set to increase electricity demand, Governor Kathy Hochul is also simultaneously working to build a new nuclear power station, New York's first in almost four decades after the Indian Point nuclear plant closed in 2021, alongside older fossil fuel plants that the state had significantly relied on for its energy. But as all-electric buildings begin to be constructed in New York, with the state building approximately 40,000 new buildings a year, Hernandez said he hopes it will begin to shift the state away from fossil fuels as New Yorkers see higher efficiency and reduced costs in action. Throughout the whole press conference,
you know, different advocates were talking about how this is very much a landmark moment and argued that this code helps protect New York from federal policies that are working to undermine New York's efforts at curbing the effects of climate change. And my question is, you know, how is this code helping New York stay on track with its climate goals?
We have about between 7 and 8 million buildings in New York State. So when you think about new buildings of only about 40,000 a year, the impact is not as big as the existing buildings really are. But what I think will happen is that homeowners of existing buildings will look and say, why do I have this old, outdated, you know, system in my home? It's more expensive. It's dirty. It's contributing to climate change. And, you know, there's just better technology out there now. And they're only building new buildings with the better technology. And I think that's going to really, in addition to a lot of the incentives that New York and the federal government are providing for people to move away from their fossil fuel combustion systems.
I just spoke with Michael Hernandez of Rewiring America on the state shift to electrification and what it means for New Yorkers. In Liberty, I'm Julie Kim for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Julia. And an update on that flash flood warning for Orange County. The National Weather Service has updated it to include West Central Orange County, specifically at 10:34. Doppler radar indicated scattered thunderstorms producing heavy rain across the warned area, now confined to the area from Port Jervis to around Middletown. Between 1 and 2 inches of rain have fallen. The expected rainfall rate is up to an inch an hour. Flash flooding of small creeks and streams, urban areas, highway streets, and underpasses, as well as other poor drainage and low-lying areas, will occur or are expected to begin shortly. Some locations that will experience flash flooding include Middletown, Port Jervis, Howells, Cuddyvackville, Otisville, Huguenot, Scotchtown, Deer Park, Mechanicstown, Maybrook, Slate Hill, Circleville, and New Hampton. Again, an update on the flash flood warning. It's now specific to West Central Orange County until 11:30 this morning. A flash flood watch remains in effect for the rest of the region as these heavy thunderstorms move through the area. Stay with Radio Catskill for continued updates. And stay with Radio Catskill as we bring you more information from the Wayne County Family Center. That's next.
Hey, it's Ira Flatow from Science Friday. Public media organizations just lost federal funding, and it is a big deal. This cut will have serious long-term consequences for the service we provide to you unless we replace that funding with support from more listeners. The future of public media is in your hands, so please go to the station's website to start or increase your monthly sustaining donation today. And thanks.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. From infant care to early learning and parenting support, the Wayne County Family Center plays a key role in helping families with young children navigate some of their most important and challenging years. Joining us live is Peggy Jones, parent educator at the Wayne County Family Center, to tell us about the services they provide, the unique needs some families are facing today, and how parents can connect with support that's close to home. Peggy, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for being here. Tell folks again more about the Wayne County Family Center. What is it that you guys exactly do there for folks with young kids?
Yeah, sure. So we're a small nonprofit. We're based in Holly, Pennsylvania. We are funded by local and state grants to provide support to families of kids ages prenatal through five in Wayne and Pike County. And two of the big things that we do are the Parents as Teachers program, which is basically, you can think of us as like an infant or a pre-K teacher that comes out to your home instead of you having to come somewhere. And we also have free play groups and a garden program that's open to anyone in the community with kids in that age group.
And I mentioned some of the unique challenges families are facing today. What are some of those challenges, and why do young families with young children need support?
Yeah, so a lot of families are facing a lot of isolation. I mean, even since, you know, restrictions from COVID have ended, like, I think a lot of people have kind of lost touch with their community and are having less and less face-to-face socialization, which is really important for kids and their development. Parents are feeling a lot of pressure, increasing pressure every year, it feels like, to have their kids have a lot of skills upon entering kindergarten. And also, a lot of parents don't have any access to preschool or early childhood education programs. There's not free programs available to everyone, and that spots fill up before everyone can sign up, even for the, paid preschool programs. And parents, there are supports available for parents with kids who aren't developing typically or have delays or a diagnosis, but a lot of those are really focused on deficits, which can be very discouraging for parents. And we are really focused on strengths and like celebrating every step of the child's journey.
Who are the teachers at the Wayne County Family Center, and how does a teacher help an infant get ready for school?
Yeah, so we are all certified trained teachers. Every single one of our teachers has at least a decade of experience working in early childhood education. And so one of the big things that we're out there promoting and teaching is that the skills that kids need to need to be ready for kindergarten start much, much earlier on than you would ever think, like even in infancy and even prenatal. So, I mean, some of the biggest skills that kids need are language skills and social and emotional skills. And those are starting even before a kid is born. Like, for example, when a mother is, rubbing and touching her pregnant belly and singing to the baby is feeling and responding to that in the womb. And that's actually beginning to teach like social and emotional skills and language skills. And then later on in infancy, literacy and math skills are already developing. Like some of their very first steps towards reading, for example, is an infant sitting in a parent's lap, pointing to pictures and babbling. They're actually learning that a picture of a cat represents a symbol for a cat, which is the first step to being able to understand words and read. And math skills actually start with exploring size and weight, like taking balls in and out of a container, pouring, filling containers. So there's all sorts of things that babies are doing to learn these skills, and we're out here bringing ideas to everyone for how they can play with this with their infant and how they can support that development, even on those really early years.
How can a family contact the Wayne County Family Center, and are you on social media? What are the best ways to get in touch?
Yeah, so we are on Facebook and on Instagram. You can find us search for us at WCFC staff on Facebook, or search for Wayne County Family Center.
And there's a family fun map too. What's this family fun map I see?
Oh yeah. So this is a project that we did this year. So one of the things that we were trying to do to combat isolation was we hear over and over again from parents, I don't know where I can go. Where is it okay for me to go with my baby who's cries and my two-year-old who runs around? Where can we be in public and meet people? That's not going to be too stressful, and that's going to be socially acceptable. And so we did a survey, interviewed a lot of people, and collected a whole bunch of locations and turned it into a map that anyone can pull up on their computer or phone, where they can find these locations and see additional information, like is it stroller friendly, does it have snacks, does it have a water fountain, all the other questions that parents have.
That's great idea. That's really informative too, and helpful to families. Peggy Jones, parent educator at the Wayne County Family Center, helping out families with young kids and giving them the support they need. Where is that water fountain exactly? Thank you so much, Peggy.
Thank you very much.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Fred, Daphne, Velma, Shaggy, and yes, Scooby, like you've never seen them before. Valerie Vancey talks to the minds behind the Madcap parody coming to Cornerstone Theater Arts next on Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week we've got the return of hippie food. It's delicious this time, with cookbook author Jess Dammit. And we get mind-blowing, simple cooking tips from one of our favorite chefs, North Carolina's own Ashley Christensen. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11, on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A groovy mystery is coming to life on stage in Goshen, and it's not your typical cartoon caper. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaks with the writers and performers William T. O'Dell and Stephen D'Ambrosio about Scooby, a Doobie parody. Their offbeat, high-energy homage to the beloved mystery-solving gang, opening next week at Cornerstone Theater Arts. It's packed with humor, nostalgia, and a dash of absurdity. It promises a fresh and very funny take on the Saturday morning classic.
Good morning, WJFF listeners. And today on Radio Chatskill, I have the pleasure of speaking with William T. O'Dell and Stephen D'Ambrosio. They are writers doing a production as part of the Cornerstone Theater summer program. And it is, well, let me just see here. It's a satirical and a historical view of the classic 1970s Saturday morning cartoon Scooby-Doo. But this summer's production is called Scooby, a Doobie musical parody. They're here to tell us all about it. So welcome.
It's great to be on the show. Hi, this is William.
Hi, this is Stephen. This is a great opportunity. Thank you so much for having us today.
Yes, well, we'd love to cover the arts. That's part of what we do, and have a great deal of respect for all of our local arts communities, theater, who put on these fabulous productions. And it's all a labor of love because the money isn't showering down. So I want to thank you for all that you do to support this vibrant arts community.
Thank you. We totally understand that it's not about the money. We love it because we want to spread joy to people, and we want to make people laugh, most importantly, with this piece. But we just love telling stories, and this is one of, I think, our funniest.
Okay, so tell us about it. Tell us about the involvement of both of you in the production.
Well, for my side of the production.
This is William.
Oh, yeah, this is William. So in my side of the production, I mainly worked on, like, the book and constructing where the story goes and making the satire element of taking Scooby-Doo and saying, okay, how do we make fun of it, but at the same time make it so that it's not just, like, silly goofy, because Scooby-Doo is already silly goofy.
Yes.
We need to make it instead thought-provoking in a way that says, okay, it's a satire. And me and Stephen worked together on the music element and the lyrics, but mainly I focused on the book.
Yeah, and for me, Stephen, my main focus was splitting pretty much the score with William, so I wrote some of the songs and some of the lyrics. Production-wise, what we got going on here now is I'm the musical director, so I got to teach all the cast their harmonies and the music. And I also get the honor of playing Fred in the production as well.
And I get to play Shaggy and Scooby-Doo.
Like Zoinks, man!
Well, what fun you're having.
It is a lot of fun. It's really silly and hilarious.
Also, I'd like to ask you about your production company and how that fits into Cornerstone Theater Arts.
Yes, so our production is at the Cornerstone Theater in Goshen, New York. Our first show is next week, Friday, August 8th at 7 p.m. We also have shows Saturday, August 9th at 2 and 7 p.m., Sunday, August 10th at 2 p.m., following week, August 16th, Saturday, which is at 2 and 7, and then the Sunday, August 17th at 2 p.m.
And where is the production?
At the Cornerstone Theater in Goshen. It's on Main Street.
And more
information. If you type it into your GPS, it'll pop right up.
Yeah.
And the website is? CornerstoneTheaterArts.org. And theater is with an R-E, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Always got to get that, but it comes up anyway. So what about your production company?
So we are actually working on a production company that does both theater and film work. entitled 2360 Do Production. And what we intend to work on is creating original pieces that we come up ourselves and helping other people with their works. Currently, we are working on a documentary with a local politician in Middletown, New York, as well as some other film projects that we hope to start picking up by next year. And so this is the first project within that, being a musical parody, because we thought that the most easy to get our foot through the door was something that was funny, that can make people laugh and entertain people first and foremost. So we're very excited to be working on that together. Me and Steven are the co-founders, and we just love making art for our community and having something to say.
And you've been involved with Cornerstone Theater Arts for a while, correct?
Yeah, we've been doing it for a little over a year now. We actually stumbled into it just by chance. It's actually a really funny story.
Well, we want to hear a funny story.
Perfect. So I was at Staples printing sheet music for this musical that I was looking into. And as I'm online, I see this guy making copies of a play with his wife. And I'm very nosy, so I just intrude and I say, is that a play? You know, and I just ask the question. And he says, well, actually, it is a play. It's The Importance of Being Earnest. So I ask, oh, that's really interesting. Are you, like, teaching it or something? And he goes, no, actually, I'm a director. We have auditions tomorrow. And I said, oh, that's great. I'm an actor. So I'd love to come audition. So he tells me more. And I found out I've been to many of their shows before. So I just say, yeah, sure, I'll come tomorrow. Funny enough, I didn't know anything about the play. I've never watched it. I've never read it. I don't know anything about The Importance of Being Earnest. So I watch it that night to get ready for it tomorrow. And I say, wait a second, this is perfect for me and Steven. So I call my friend Steven up. I say, do you want to audition for a show tomorrow? And he said, yes. He didn't know what it was. He also never watched or read The Importance of Being Earnest, but I said, hey, I think we'd be great for the two lead guys. And we went the next day, auditioned, and then a week later we heard back, and I was right. We got the two lead guys. So it was a really funny story. And since then we found a family here. And the wonderful director, Mark, he's been really good to us. And Evelyn, our producer and the artistic director here at Cornerstone, she's been like a mother. She's amazing. And the whole Cornerstone family has just welcomed us with open arms and accepted our crazy, silly, stupid humor and our crazy, silly, stupid ideas.
Well, that's great. I love crazy, silly, stupid humor. We all need that. Before I end, I have to say that a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed the founder of Murder Cafe. They're based out of Rosendale. And he told a very similar story about he had been called to do something he knew nothing about and then fell in love with Murder Cafe type of theater. So sometimes that happens. Let's review. The title is
Scooby-A-Dooby Musical Parody.
Folks can get more information about this at cornerstonetheaterarts.org, and that's theater with an R-E. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us and share this fun event with our listeners.
Thank you. This was so much fun, and we can't wait to listen to it with our families on the radio.
Okay.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that. Zoinks. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new releases, film festivals, nostalgic screenings, live music events, and more. Information and schedule at thecalicoontheater.com.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. A reminder, a flash flood warning remains in effect until 11:30 for West Central Orange County. It's the area between Port Jervis to around Middletown. Between 1 and 2 inches of rain have already fallen, and additional amounts of 1 inch are possible in that warned area. A flash flood watch remains in effect for the rest of the region through this evening as scattered thunderstorms producing heavy rain move across the area. Stay with Radio Catskill for continued updates.